The following interview took place at the 18th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Miami, Florida, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Recognizing Signs, Saving Lives, Youth Suicide Prevention Strategies, a conversation with Dr. Jonathan B. Singer, interviewed by Mrs. Rivka Krinsky and Mrs. Ida Schottenstein.
Thanks so much for being here. We're talking about something very important, something life-changing. I want to just start by introducing our very special guest, Dr. Jonathan Singer. He's an internationally recognized expert in youth suicide and social work technology. He's professor of social work at Loyola University of Chicago, past president of the American Association of Suicidology, co-authors of two editions of the best-selling text, Suicide in Schools, A Practitioner's Guide to Multi-Level Prevention, Assessment, Intervention, and Postvention. He's founder and host of the award-winning Social Work Podcast, for which he was named the NASW Social Work Pioneer in 2023. In 2024, he was inducted as a Fellow of the Society for Social Work and Research. It's quite an impressive bio there, and we're so honored to be here to have this conversation with you. I want to start just by thanking you and with a question about a little bit about your background. I would imagine the career that you've chosen is not an easy one to be in. You probably deal with some of the most difficult aspects of the human experience. So I'd like to know, can you tell us what inspired you, what motivates you to do what you do?
Yeah, well, thank you for having this conversation with me. I appreciate it. When I was in the 11th grade, T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, Virginia, they put on the play Ordinary People, which was a book, and then it was an Academy Award-winning movie, and it's about a family who struggles with the death of the oldest son, and then the younger son attempts suicide. And what does it mean for the kid, the family, the school? What is it like? And I was captivated by the topic, and the drama teacher had a counselor come talk to us as a cast, and then after every performance facilitated a conversation with the audience about what did you see, what was that like, what was the experience. I thought, what, people have these conversations about this? That's amazing. And so fast forward, several years, 8 years, 9 years, I can't remember. And I graduate with my MSW, and the first job I get is working at a mobile crisis unit for children and adolescents. And what I do day in and day out is suicide risk assessments, right? So I was working with families. They were not as well off financially as the ones in Ordinary People, but they were struggling with these same issues.
Wow, it's amazing when something impacts you profoundly, and then God presented you with this particular task to take on, to guide people in this very thing that you found fascinating.
Yeah.
Usually, it's a life experience that you've experienced yourself, but it seems like you experienced from looking at it from the outside in.
Yeah.
And observing another family, which is actually very endearing. That because it's usually comes from something within you, but you actually were very thoughtful about others. So I wanted to ask you, can you share some surprising statistics that we might not be aware of in the youth today in suicide?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think about youth suicide, we think about the kids who have tragically died by suicide. Every year, there's about 6,000 kids under the age of 25 who die by suicide in the United States, which every single one of those is a tragedy, and we absolutely need to do everything in our our power every single day to prevent those suicide deaths. But it's also a very rare occurrence statistically, because there are 80-some million kids under the age of 25. Right, so out of 80-some million people, 6,000 die, right, which is what we call low base rate behavior. The number that is much higher that we end up addressing on a day-to-day basis, and this is the surprising part, is kids who have thoughts of suicide, kids who are engaging in behaviors with the intention of ending their life. So you have kids who are, according to the Youth Risk Behavior Survey through the Centers for Disease Control, about a third of high school girls reported thoughts of suicide in the past year, right? So 30% of high school girls reported thoughts of suicide, and about 14% of high school boys. So that is a much larger number, right, than the number of deaths. And so when we think about suicide deaths, obviously that is that's the thing we're wanting to stop. We're wanting to stop the deaths. But the thing that we work with most often are actually thoughts of suicide, right? And there's a much larger percentage of kids who are struggling with suicidal thoughts, most of whom never go on to attempt or die by suicide.
How do you know when it's serious and that they are really going to do it, and when it's not serious?
I love that question. So what I always, and this is hard, I always encourage people to take it seriously. Anytime you hear a kid talking about, I don't think that people would care whether I lived or died, or I don't think there's a place for me in this world, right? People don't get me. So take that seriously. In terms of when the thoughts turn into actions that turn into death, what we find is that kids who are experiencing more severe depressive symptoms, anxiety symptoms, kids who are engaging in self-harming behaviors, even if they're not suicidal, right? So maybe a typical self-harming behavior, non-suicidal self-harming behavior for boys would be punching walls, banging their heads, doing something like that. For girls, it tends to be more cutting and burning. So if you have kids that are experiencing more depression, more anxiety, more self-harming behavior, and if they're using substances, right? The more you add on to that, the more likely it is you're going to get kids who move from thoughts to behaviors. And then when we know is that kids who are engaging in suicidal behaviors, if they're experiencing psychotic symptoms, right? So hearing voices, seeing things, feeling things, or if they're using substances at the moment, then they engage in much more lethal suicide attempts.
It's a pretty crazy statistic that many kids are actually thinking about suicide. I wonder how early should we be educating kids on, you know, the importance of like suicide awareness or how young should we be talking to them about this kind of stuff, whether or not they're displaying signs of, you know, suicidal thoughts.
So one of the things that's I think really important to remember when we're talking about suicide prevention is that the flip side of preventing suicide is promoting life, right? It's building hope. And so the question about age really speaks to that idea of like, at what age do we start building hope? Do we start building reasons for living? Do we start saying, this is a world that you would want to stick around and live in? And I think that can start at any time and should, right? And I think a lot of what we do with younger kids is that. In terms of suicide-specific curriculum, definitely think that, you know, no later than fifth grade should we get kids who, should we provide information about suicide, because that is the age where you start to see this rise in suicidal thoughts and behaviors.
Right. So I saw something interesting and I would love to hear your thoughts on this, that in the media, when there are reports on suicide, like on the news, the suicide rate actually increases. And that's why I saw that they included a number for a hotline at the bottom of the screen because of that. Can you speak to that?
And also in relation to what you just said, because if we're going to educate our kids when they're younger, that could spark a thought within them if they have tendencies towards depression or if they're feeling lonely?
Okay, so those are two very good but different topics. So let me address the media one, and then we'll address the question about if you talk about suicide, is that going to increase suicide risk? Because I think it's a really important one. So in the field of suicide prevention, there is this effect, we call it the Werther effect, or Werther in German, and it's it is based on the opera that where the protagonist was killed himself, and there was this after reading about a death. And so the idea is that when the media presents information about how somebody died by suicide, where they died, when they died, when they get all the details about the method, the place, that there's a lot of data, like there's 40 plus years of research to suggest that that actually results in an increase in suicide deaths, short term, but it results in an increase. There's a corollary, which is called the Papageno effect, which is that when you talk about suicides, but you use that as an opportunity to talk about warning signs, about things that people can do, about resources, that actually has a protective effect population-wise. And so the media is powerful, right? The information that it shares is powerful, and you can either report on things in a way that increases risk or decreases risk.
That's not always in our control, but yeah.
That's right. It's not always in our control, but if you're... say, for example, you work in a school. There should be somebody at the school district or in a school who has a relationship with the media, right? The local reporter or whatever. And there are reporting guidelines that have been out for a long time. There are a couple of different versions. I worked on one of them. There's a website, reportingonsuicide.com. And making sure that journalists are aware of how to report on suicide is really important. And so if you're a community mental health agency, if you're working in a faith community, if you're working in a school, having a relationship with a journalist and saying, hey, so do you know about these? And so we just had this suicide death in our community. I just want to remind you, like, this is how you report on it. These are the things that are good to do, and these are the things that are discouraged from doing. Right. Yeah. Now, you had a question about talking about suicide and what that does. So I think with any topic that is any topic that can be unfamiliar to a kid, you have to sort of enter it in a way that it makes sense to them, right? Which is one of the reasons why some of the programs like DARE failed so spectacularly. Right, because they were introducing this idea of not using drugs to kids who were not thinking about using drugs, right? And so then they were like, oh, well, this sounds like a good idea, right? There's no evidence to suggest that the programs that are out there that are addressing suicide risk have had any of those same effects, in part because we learned from the DARE program mistake about what not to do, right? And so one of the things you don't do is you don't go out there and say, you don't try and scare kids about suicide, which doesn't even make any sense. But talking about suicide as a community issue is something that kids at a young age can understand, right? They have friends who are struggling. And what do? How do they respond when they see one of their friends who is sad, who is afraid? Who do they talk to, right? So that's the first step, is to say the adults in your life can be helpful. You can go to them and they will be able to help your friend. This message is really important. And there's a program called the Good Behavior Game. There was research study that Holly Wilcox and colleagues did on the Good Behavior Game, which was for first and second graders, about being connected with with adults in the classroom about addressing aggressive behaviors. And what they found was that after 20-some years, like 20 years after these kids did this game, those that went through it were half as likely to attempt suicide than the kids who did not, right? And part of it was that they built up this community of supports in their schools to say, I can go to you, or you are an adult that I can trust. And so that's the first part of the conversation. Now, when you get older and you have kids that have been thinking about suicide, or you have kids whose friends have attempted or have talked about it, having the adults in the room bring it up isn't going to put the idea into their heads. They've already thought about it, right? And there's some things that we're just not going to think about. Like if I said to you guys, I'm like, hey, let's go shoot heroin. You wouldn't be like, oh, now I want to shoot heroin. Like it's not something that really happens, right? So there's some things that when we bring them up and we bring them up in a supportive way and we bring them up in a way that says this is a resource, then it takes some of the power away from that idea and it then becomes a community issue and a community solution.
I like that because it also encourages being loving to somebody else and thoughtful and coming home and saying to your parents, you know, this friend of mine is really sad, like to start there, what should I do? And that we encourage them to do something for them.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the relationship between isolation, loneliness, and suicidality? Or, you know, are there certain mental health disorders that correlate with a higher, you know, increased rate in suicide risk?
Yeah, so for youth, we see that social isolation is highly correlated with loneliness. And that might sound obvious, but for older adults, social isolation is not as strongly correlated with loneliness. There are lots of older adults that don't mind not being surrounded by people all the time, right? But it's not true for youth. And so social
isolation... Is that a fact? Like, kids don't want to be isolated? I'm saying most kids want to be with other kids?
Yeah, most kids want to be with other kids.
I'm now, saying all kids or most?
Most kids. Mm-hmm. There are some kids, right? So you get kids who are on the autism spectrum, right, for whom social connections can be distressing, right? Being around other kids, not knowing sort of what's happening, that can be distressing. But in general, kids want to be around other kids, which is one of the reasons why I think the pandemic was so challenging for a lot of kids, because even though they had social media for connections, they actually missed out on the physical proximity. But in terms of the diagnoses that are most strongly correlated with suicide risk, it changes as kids get older. So some research by Ariel Scheftal and colleagues looking at suicide deaths for kids under the age of 11 found that the most common diagnosis associated with suicide deaths was attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and that black youth were twice as likely to die by suicide as white youth in the under 11 age group. Now, when you get over 11, you start getting more of the depression, anxiety, and importantly, eating disorders, right? So kids who struggle with anorexia have the highest rate of suicide amongst any sort of one disorder. And that's not that they die because of the malnourishment and sort of the physical effects, it's that it's actual suicide death. So anyway, those are some of the diagnoses. And importantly, it varies because we see depression and anxiety and eating disorders, rates of those disorders increase significantly at puberty, right? So you get ADHD is the most common diagnosis in kids under the age of 11 because it's a neurodevelopmental disorder, right? That is the age at which it happens, and then afterwards you get these other diagnoses.
You could have one person who has ADHD and one who has depression, let's say. ADHD and one who's lonely, mm-hmm. and one has suicide thoughts and one doesn't.
Right.
So how would you know How would that come to be that one has the suicide thoughts and one doesn't? Is it because they have a DNA of depression or mental health issues? Or could it really be the loneliness and the ADHD, or being so lonely that it causes you to want to commit suicide, whereas another person, it wouldn't?
So there are lots of reasons why people might start to think about suicide, right? And there are lots of reasons why people might act on suicidal thoughts. So two things. One, there is some research, and David Brent, who's one of the premier suicidologists in the world, has done some research looking at the genetic transmission of suicide risk. And there is some suggestion that there might be an aggressive, impulsive gene that's associated with suicide risk over time, right, across generations. But like most genetic research, it's hard to kind of hang your hat on that. The other thing is that when you think about isolation, and kids who struggle with ADHD oftentimes feel socially isolated, right? Because they're acting in ways that annoy their peers, frustrate the adults around them, right? It's a highly problematic diagnosis in terms of feeling socially connected. And so you could have a kid who is, again, physically around people, but feels shut out, right? And that can contribute to feelings of loneliness. And if you're a kid, especially when you move into adolescence, where one of the primary developmental tasks is finding your peer group, right? If you feel like you don't have your peer group, then you might wonder, is this ever going to get any better? What is the point of sticking around in a world where nobody wants to be my friend, right? And so the way that you know, well, is this an ADHD kid? Is this a lonely kid? Is this a suicidal kid? Is that you ask the question. And this is a really important thing, which is that you can't make somebody suicidal by asking them if they're having thoughts of killing themselves. But what you can do is you can identify somebody who's having thoughts of suicide, and you can do something about it.
How would you identify?
So you would say, so, you know, one of the things that I've noticed is that there was this thing that happened with your group of friends, and you're no longer hanging out with them. And I know that sometimes when that happens, when somebody feels like they've been rejected by their friends, that even if it's not something that they've ever thought before, or is really even something that they would ever think that they would be thinking, that they have thoughts of ending their life, that they have thoughts about killing themselves pop into their heads. And I'm just wondering if that's happened to you lately, right? So you couch it and you're like, not shameful, not embarrassing, but I'm just gonna throw it out there. And what the research shows is that if somebody has been recently thinking about suicide, asking them if they're suicidal actually decreases their level of distress, right? Around the suicidal thoughts. And so in and of itself, it is protective because you've decreased distress and you've reached out and you've created a connection.
So I want to talk about parental guilt for a second, because okay. You know, being a parent is not easy. I imagine the parents feel responsible for the distress that their children experience, whether they're having suicidal thoughts or not. You mentioned a few things like promoting life and maybe paying attention to some of the warning signs like increased aggressive behavior. Can you talk about maybe some other things that parents or caregivers or even community members can do? What would you say to a parent who feels deep guilt and a sense of responsibility for their child's well-being?
As a parent, I certainly know the experience of feeling guilt, of feeling kind of the pain of missing the boat, right? Of doing something that you think is the right thing to do, and then you find out it totally wasn't the right thing to do, right? This is where that instruction manual will be really good. What I would say, a couple things for parents, right? So for parents who know that their kid is suicidal, that's absolutely a situation where you need to have some support. You need the therapist. You want to find out which parents in your community you can talk to about what's going on. If you're before kids express suicidal thoughts, I think it's really important for parents to have this conversation as well, right? There are lots of things that parents can do one-on-one with their kids, but there are lots of things that are much better when it's a community effort, right? And having the conversation about if your kid mentions something to you about something my kid says, would you feel comfortable telling me? Right, so that very basic like network effect. Having a conversation about what do you think if a kid is talking about suicide, as a parent, who do you think is to blame? Because what you don't want to do is you don't want to then go to the parent, your friends, and be like, oh, so my kid's having these thoughts, and for them to be like, well, how did you screw up? Right, so you want to have safe people to talk to as well. In the same way we talk to kids about having safe peers, adults need to have that too. So anyway, those are just a couple of things that I would suggest for parents to do. And the last thing I'll say is that when kids, and I said this before, but there are lots of reasons why kids might be suicidal, but I really think that helping parents to recognize that they are one of the best solutions to the problem of suicide is important, right? The relationship that a kid has with their parent is outside of their, whoever their partner is going to be one of the longest relationships they ever have. And so if you are able to talk with your kid about this potentially shameful and embarrassing topic in a way that makes them feel like they are being loved and supported, that is going to open the door for all sorts of other conversations, right? And where they're going to be like, oh, my parents are people I can go to. And the parents are like, I can do that for my kids. Attachment-based family therapy is a treatment that is built around this exact idea.
It's specifically for parents?
It's for parents of kids who are suicidal. So it's a family therapy. And so the whole thing is about identifying where the relationship has broken down, which they call relational ruptures, and it is structured to repair that relationship.
So if a parent doesn't feel comfortable to go to talk to other parents in the community, mm-hmm. they can go to this resource.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because sometimes families feel like they want to be very private about it, or the child themselves doesn't want the parents to share anything with anybody else. So is this what you would tell them to do?
It's certainly, doing ABFT is certainly a resource. If ABFT is not around, some other forms of therapy where they include the parents, cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, some of these are very sort of evidence-based in terms of addressing suicide risk. And what I will say is that this issue of being able to find community for parents is, I think, one of the biggest problems that we have in the field of suicide prevention right now, because
there's a lot of shame around it and people don't want to talk.
There's a lot of shame, there's a lot of embarrassment, and let's say that your kid has been struggling with suicidal thoughts on and off for the last year, and now they're not. They've sort of gotten over this phase. They're into their activities, they're looking forward to whatever it is, and you are like, okay, now I can move on with my life also. You probably don't want to spend like all of your free time talking about it with other families, right? So you also are moving on to something else. And so there is a challenge for how to build community around this so that it doesn't create an undue burden on families who have really struggled.
And what would you say would be a step that families can take towards that, towards communicating?
Well, so I think this absolutely should be something that is brought up in environments where families are. So if, during a DVAR, during a community event, somebody other than the family should be bringing this up. The rabbi should bring this up, right? The imam, the pastor, whoever the faith leader is, needs to be bringing up addressing suicide on a regular basis so that it's not the families that are saying, I'm going to take the lead on this. Now they can, but then it really places the burden on a family that might already feel shamed and embarrassed and burdened, right? So making it a community issue, I think, is really important.
So hard as parents to find that balance between like helping versus enabling, knowing when we're supposed to just, you know, let them figure things out on their own and work through things, and when we need to step in. This just sounds like there's not one right answer, but we're all figuring this out as we go. As a parent, or even as a counselor or practitioner, could you share a personal experience that was impactful to you in this space that stuck with you, or that you want, you know, think we could benefit from hearing?
So I think almost every experience that I've had has been impactful. And one of the things that I will say about my experience working with suicidal kids and their families is that early on, I realized that it was really about hope, right? So working with suicidal kids is really about finding that piece of them that wants to live and that energy in the family that's going to support that. And that is a very hopeful experience. There was back in 96, when I first started working for the mobile crisis unit, there was a girl who came in. She's a 10th grader from Honduras, and her mom, they had been in this country for 6 or 7 years. And the mom had grounded the daughter, because the daughter had walked home from high school with a boy, and it was just the two of them. And that was a no-no, right? The boy and the girl do not walk together, right? They just don't do that. And the girl was like, are you kidding me? Like, compared to the things that my peers are doing, like, this is what you think is problematic? And the mom was like, where I grew up, it's a huge problem. And the fact that you did it means that you're starting to lose who you are, right? You're starting to become somebody that I don't recognize, and so I'm gonna ground you. And the girl was like, this is not gonna work for me. So she tried to kill herself. And so that's when I met them. And we worked on, and it sounds very simple in the retelling, but I helped them to see that in the times where their relationship became more conflictual, the girl's desire to die increased. And the times that the mom was doing things that the girl felt like were keeping her from being a normal teenager also were related to increases in suicide risk. And we did a whole lot of work. And after a month, I'm talking like we were together 3 or 4 days a week for a month. At the end of the month, the girl was no longer suicidal, got her connected with another therapist. I'm tearing up. 2 years later, I got a graduation announcement, and it was the most beautiful graduation announcement I'd ever seen, because in my world, graduating from high school was a given. But for this girl, it was not, right? She was this close to not being alive. And then she wrote this graduation announcement. She was like, hey, Jonathan, I just want to let you know that I made it.
Wow.
And so, yeah.
And how did the mother feel about this? Was their relationship restored? And
yeah, the mom was really happy, and she, like, the whole experience kind of helped the mom to kind of get into a different space. I mean, the mom was really in like the survival mode, right?
And but, did this girl have mental illness? Or was it that her relationship was so bad with her mother and that she wasn't able to be herself that led her to this?
So So the category of mental illness is kind of, it's pretty broad. Like, so they experienced a lot of trauma leading up to their time through Honduras into the United States, right? And so she definitely met criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. So technically, she met criteria for a mental illness. But her suicidal behaviors and her suicidal thoughts were not because of the mental illness, if that makes sense, right? It was very relational. It was about what was going on in terms of who she wanted to be, about culture, about acculturation, about what it means to be an American, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and this is a thing about suicide, which is in 2018, the CDC put out a study that said 56% of people who died by suicide did not have a mental health diagnosis at the time of their death. So this is another sort of surprising fact about suicide, which is that it can exist outside of what we think of as mental illness.
Wow, that's really shocking.
Yeah.
What are some other surprising statistics or things that you discovered in this space that are not like commonsensical?
So I think one of the things is that asking people about suicide doesn't make them suicidal,
right?
That's an important kind of myth. Another thing that most people probably would be surprised about is that you have a gender paradox. So when I talked about a third of high school girls reported thoughts of killing themselves in the past year, the most number of kids who died by suicide were actually boys. And so in the United States, you have about three times as many boys die by suicide as girls, but about three times as many girls as boys reporting thoughts of suicide. And one of the reasons is because boys use more lethal means. So they'll use suffocation or firearms, and girls will use pills and cutting, right? Which are the least lethal methods. They're not serious, they're just less lethal. And if we got rid of all the firearms in the United States, we would cut the suicide rate in half overnight, because about 55% of suicide deaths are with a firearm. Two-thirds of all firearm deaths are suicides. And so if you want to find an issue that can bring politicians together across the aisle, it's reducing suicide deaths by firearms.
In a crisis, like crisis intervention, like we talked about mitigating and knowing the warning signs, seeing them, what we can do to prevent suicide. What about like in that state when someone is maybe attempting or saying, I'm going to do it? What does a caregiver or someone who's there do in that situation?
So if you're in a situation where you have somebody who's saying, yes, I'm, like, not only am I having thoughts of suicide, but I want to end my life. The first thing to remember is that that level of suicidal crisis is transient, especially for youth, meaning that kids cannot hang out in that level of suicidal crisis for very long. And what very long is varies with the age of the kid and what's going on. But the first piece of advice is to stay with the kid. Right? Not to leave them alone, to be physically present. And in that sense, you're preventing suicide by preventing them from having access to whatever lethal means they might be using. The other thing is to be very structured about what's going to happen over the next 8 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours. And so particularly if you're working with a therapist, And the kid is not going to the hospital, which hospitals are overused these days for kids who are suicidal because there are fewer and fewer community resources, but hospitals are not great for addressing suicide risk because they are short-term, right? So you get kids who are going into a hospital and then 72 hours later they're discharged, which doesn't give anybody enough time to actually address the issues. It might give the parents enough time to get a good night's sleep, might give the kid time to get, you know, talk to a psychiatrist about their medications, but So when you talk to a therapist, you want to make sure that you are coming up with a plan. What's going to happen when we leave? What's going to happen tonight? What's it going to look like when a sibling might say, well, what's happening, right? Should you double down on structure and consequences for things like using a phone or staying up late? Like, so you want to come up with a plan, and you want to make sure that the next day, and that can include even something like overnight, like the kid stays in your room. There are people who are like, have taken doors off of the kid's bedroom. You know, they've got monitors now you can put in. There's all sorts of things, you know, for a suicidal crisis that's at that level. But having a plan, and there's a tool called a safety plan, right? So safety planning intervention. And for we developed something called the homeschool safety plan, which is a variation of that, which means that you write down things you can do by yourself in school and at home, people you can talk to at home and at school, places you can go at home and at school to distract you from your suicidal thoughts. Coming up with that plan and being able to enact that over the 24 hours is really important in that immediate suicidal crisis.
And that plan is on your website.
Yeah, so safety planning is something that you can find almost anywhere if you just Google safety planning.
Right.
We developed the homeschool safety plan in the second edition of our book, Suicide in Schools, and it's freely accessible to anybody as well.
And it's probably unique to every person because some kids want their family around, some kids don't. So you have to speak to someone specific about it besides just looking at it online, you would suggest.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, the whole family should be involved in the creation of the safety plan.
Right.
I'm still stuck on this thing that you shared about how a lot of them don't have any predispositions for a lot of people who commit suicide or remind me of the terminology.
Oh, that's good.
I know that you mentioned
that
we don't use the...
Right.
So it's commit suicide.
That's right. So commit suicide is considered problematic because of the association of the word commit with commit murder and commit rape and even being committed to a psychiatric institution. So the phrase is die by suicide.
Right.
Right. And so, and there are a couple other phrases that we could talk about, but the idea about the mental illness and the suicidal behavior, just to be clear, it's not that these are folks that died by suicide, like out of the blue. These were people who the primary concern was the suicidal thoughts, and it wasn't necessarily that they had a diagnosis.
Right.
And that it was sort of through that diagnosis that they were suicidal. And this is an important stat because the original stats on suicide deaths were based on retrospective reports. And in retrospect, you can look at somebody who died by suicide and say, well, clearly they were depressed. Because otherwise, how would they have thought that life was hopeless? Clearly that's depression, right? And so we had this understanding that suicide was something that had happened almost exclusively through mental illness. But we don't think that way anymore.
Wow, that is very interesting. You know, my favorite word that you shared here today is hope. And I think that the story that you shared is so hopeful as well for us to be able to hear that the girl that you helped, it led to her graduation, and you're the one that gave her hope. And hope is something we really need in our lives. And actually, you were talking about a manual, and recently I got this, it's a book that just came out. It's called Letters for Life, Guidance for Emotional Wellness from the Lubavitch Rebbe. And there's many people who wrote into the Lubavitch Rebbe in their lifetime that had suicidal thoughts, that were depressed. And I really like this book. There's a lot on loneliness and what to do with that. And when you're actually in hospital, what someone can do there. And I just wanted to recommend it. And I'd love to give you one.
I'd love to have one. Thank you.
But we always end episodes with a favorite quote or a parting message. And one of mine that I'm thinking of when I speak to you is, to the world, you might be one person, but to one person, you might be the world. Okay. And I see in the story that you shared, that's what you were for this girl. And as parents, we can all be that for our children. And Ida, I thought maybe before we go to questions, you could share something, and then the doctor can share something.
Share a quote or just share my thoughts?
Say your thoughts.
I think from this conversation, which was gave me a lot of new information, new insight that I think is important just as a parent and as a, you know, as a someone in a relationship with many different types of people. I think one of the things, like, people often get overwhelmed, you know, when they feel a sense of responsibility, but they don't really have control over, you know, whether they're, what their kids are doing at school, or even parents who have, you know, let their kids have phones and social media. Like, there's so much that we don't have control over. But I think I'd like to think of the little things that we can do. And I feel like one small thing can lead to another, can lead to another. So, like what you mentioned about removing the door, I think maybe not putting locks on kids' bedroom doors can be an easy one, or, you know, putting limits on phones, like, if, and not, you're limiting use of social media, limiting it altogether.
Yeah, and also when you shared about if a kid is sad in school, that just talking to your kid about how to deal with a sad friend is a step towards the right direction.
Yeah, I think there's always something small, and just to not be overwhelmed at the scope of this issue. It's a big one, especially now. So I think for my takeaway is it's an overwhelming thing, and we don't know who's, sometimes we don't see struggles. You know, we don't know who's really struggling. And I think we could do little things, even send someone a text, you know, say, hey, checking in. The quote that Rivka just mentioned was a quote that was connected to a story about someone who was actually going to commit, he was attempting suicide, and he went to, I think, the Golden Gate Bridge, and he did jump, and he died by suicide. And they found a note in his room, in his house, that said, I'm going to kill myself, and if one person stops to say hello to me, then either he said, maybe I won't, or I won't. And then, of course, no one stopped to say hello. So I think it was after that story that someone had shared that they said to, you know, to the world, you might be one person, but to one person, you might be the world. So I think we can all do something. That's my takeaway.
And what's yours?
Well, so I think that one of the things that, going off of what you just said, right, which is that we can feel overwhelmed, we can feel guilty, we can feel embarrassed, like when we miss things. And so one of the quotes I love is, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, and the second best time is right now, right? So, like, we might have missed it, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it anyway, right? It's a great thing about life. We get lots of opportunities to get it right. And so, like, maybe you let your kids have social media when they were 11, and you're like, this isn't working out so well. So you have a chance to do it differently, right? So that's what I would say.
It's a good message.
Yep, great message. Does anyone have any questions in the audience?
At what age do I think it's right to start talking about suicide in schools? So, yeah, preventing suicide, yeah. So I think that you can definitely start at fifth grade, like using the word suicide and start talking about people killing themselves. I think that before that, you can do a lot of the things to build up community, right? And to build up thoughts about, like, skills about, like, well, what do I do when I'm struggling with these feelings, or how do I reach out to somebody, and then what are they gonna do? I think you can do those things earlier, which is sort of what we talk about as suicide prevention.
Yeah. Okay, we have one question here.
So the question was about internal family systems, right, which is Dick Schwartz's therapy model, and this idea that we have different parts inside of us. And what I'll say is that, yes, I think IFS and that idea is really powerful. And also, Dick mentioned this in a webinar. He said, because of the movie Inside Out, kids and parents have a framework to talk about this, right? And so one of the beautiful things about the movie Inside Out was that it illustrated how sadness is really important, right? And so when somebody's feeling sad, our job is not to push that away, right? Our job is to understand what is the benefit, what comes with sadness, right? And to recognize that as part of the human experience, right? Like, don't, you know, just because I'm having a rough day doesn't mean that it's a sign of weakness. It might actually be one of the days that I'm fighting my hardest, right? So, like, let's move with that. And so I think that parts work or inside out work, right? However you want to call it, I think can
be really
powerful.
There's a sequel too. Inside Out 2 is also great. It's so good. Latest one. They introduced anxiety into the
anxiety
equation.
Ennui. Big question. What I will say is that if you have a kid who's got some sort of lethal method in hand and they're planning on doing it, ideally you will have worked with them on a plan so that they are actually not alone in that moment, so that they know, I've got this method, I've got a gun, I've got whatever, I need to go reach out to somebody, right? And maybe the message that they've heard you say and they've heard their parents say, they've heard their friends say is, it doesn't matter what's going on, the world is better with you here than with you not here, right? Which is a tough thing for people to believe in that moment. But let's say that this is way before they have the WEP method in their hand. I think that what you brought up about the internalized messages is really important, right? And that's where object relations theory really does a lot of good work in terms of being able to identify what it is that we've internalized, the messages and the voices. And so if you have a kid who mentions, well, I hear this voice and it says you're a bad person, you don't deserve to live, you can explore, well, where did that voice come from? Who said that? What does it sound like? All those sorts of things. And that's part of the therapy work.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming to this important conversation. Thank you, Dr. Singer.
Yeah,
thank
thanks
you for all your insights.
Yeah, thank you for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Have a great day.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.